So last week we were in Genesis chapter 6, verses 13 through 16, and I don't have that projecting for some reason. Let me just turn this on. See if it'll come up. Remember, God had looked down on the earth and saw that the earth was corrupt and it was filled with violence, and he decided, it says that he regretted making man, and he regretted it. The idea, the King James says, repented of making mankind, which is a strong word. Down in verse 13, God commands Noah. He says, make an ark of gopher wood, make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and outside with pitch. And this is how you shall make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, its width 50 cubits, its height 30 cubits. You shall make a window for the ark, and you shall finish it a cubit from above, and set a door in the ark in its side, and you shall make it lower with lower, second, and third decks. And that's kind of where we left off. I've got a couple. I'm going to fast forward through this cartoon and this story that we saw last week, talking about the global flood. Again, I took these pictures. Oh, I may not have taken these pictures, but this is what you see if you go to the Ark Encounter in Kentucky. They've done a full-scale ark. And they decided instead of using an 18-inch cubit, they decided to use a 21.5-inch cubit or a 20-inch cubit, which is called a royal cubit. And it, to tell you the truth, it doesn't make a huge amount of difference. Well, it makes a little bit of difference because it extends the size of the boat. But when you think about the size of the ark, it's incredibly large. In regards to a football field, if you're using the royal cubit, it's at least as wide as a football field, 87.5 feet wide, because it's 300 cubits long, and if you multiply that by 21 and divide by 12, you get 525 feet. That's almost the length of two football fields. And I say this to kind of get your mind in thinking of comparisons here. This room is about 50 feet wide and about 60 feet long. Think about how large the ark is in comparison to this room. I mean, it's as wide as our building, and it's, what, 10 times longer than this room. And it's 50, instead of 19 feet tall at the top of it, it's 52 feet tall. That's 21 times, what is the cubit? what did it say the cubit was again? 25 or 30, I can't remember now, I just looked at it. 30 cubits, sorry. I had a Downey moment there, a senior moment. That you multiply 30, take 30, multiply it times 21 or 21.5, however you want to define the royal cubit, or 18, and it ends up being either 45 feet tall, so at least as tall as a four-story building, and higher, a five-story building if you're using a royal cubit. That's tall. And then he's got decks on it, three decks, and each of the decks, if it's almost 60 feet tall, each of the decks is almost 20 feet tall. So what kind of animals can you fit? How many cages do you think you can fit into a place like that? Now, we said that the size of the average land animal is the size of a what? A sheep. So if you think about it, because you've got the little tiny shrews, the shrew is the smallest animal, apparently, mammal. What's the largest land animal? The African elephant. What's the second largest land animal? The Indian elephant. You know what the third and fourth are? The rhinoceros and the hippo. So now you start thinking, now rhinoceroses are pretty big animals. Elephants are pretty big animals when they're full grown, right? You think God would have brought to Noah a full-grown African elephant, you know, one that was already, you know, 30, 40 years old or something like that? Then he's going to bring something younger in the prime of its life. I would assume that. So is he going to have the 23-ton animal, or is he going to have a 2-ton animal? Which is easier to handle in a situation like this? God's not going to make it hard on Noah to do what he wants him to do. And so you've got, like, I show these pictures because I think they're kind of neat. You know, when we had guinea pigs, we had little water bottles so that we didn't put a little cup of water in there because they just soil it. We had water bottles, and they would come out and they'd get water when they wanted water. And that's what they're doing here. And it's interesting if you go look at some of the pictures that they've got, and then they've got the bigger cages and stuff like that. This is part of a diorama picture, but this is the actual stuff that they have in there. What I love about it is they also have dinosaurs in their cages. And I said, I think I misspoke last week and said the average size of a dinosaur was a chicken. I was wrong. I looked it back up again. It's actually the size of a buffalo, what we would call a buffalo or an American bison. Still, the size of the average dinosaur size is the size of a large cow. Full grown buffalo, right. Full grown bison. I always want to say buffalo, but, huh?
Full grown dinosaur for that size of
the average size of a full grown dinosaur. Right. So there were a lot of little dinosaurs. Now keep in mind too that when we're going to get to it, he's not going to say each of every species in here. He's going to say each of every kind. So does he have water buffalo and American buffalo? You know, American bison. Does he have cows, or does he have the cow kind? So when you start looking at kinds, it reduces the amount of animals that are coming onto the ark quite a bit. And when you start looking at the differentiation between clean animals and unclean animals, it also changes the differentiation. How many clean animals are there? Well, is a camel clean? No, so there's only two of those. Are cows clean? Yes, they are. So there are seven of those. And we'll see, most people think, you know, just if they haven't read the chapter lately, they'll think, you know, two by two, they came into the ark. Well, two by two, except if they're clean, and then seven of them came on board, which is really helpful because later on, what's Noah going to do with one of each of those clean animals? He's going to sacrifice them, right? And Sheila says, eat them, which is most likely what's going to happen. Not only the sacrificing, but the eating of them, because God allows Noah at that point to start eating meat. And so we see the cages. They had, again, the Ark Encounter, they have all sorts of dinosaur kinds on there. It's kind of fun. But let's say that Noah wanted to, or God wanted to save the Brachiosaurus, which is one of the largest dinosaurs that there is out there. We used to call it a brontosaurus when I was a kid, but they call it a Brachiosaurus. It's a long neck, right? If you've seen Land Before Time, it's a long neck. And it's they're large. I mean, they dwarf a car. You suppose God's going to bring a full-grown Brachiosaurus to Noah to put on the ark? I don't think so. And how big are Brachiosaurus eggs, by the way? You know, they're about like that. They're not very big, you know, like the size of a football. So how big are Brachiosauruses when they're born? They're small. They're really small. So, I mean, there are all sorts of answers to the logistics of how much you could get on an ark. And I brought this back up because I want to put this picture on here. This ark here is this traditional 18-inch cubit. It's 450 feet long, so it's a football field and a half, right? It's not quite the length of two football fields, but still, go run a 100-yard dash and tell me how long that is. You know, I'll walk a 100-yard dash and tell you how long that is, but it's long. And then you've got the number of rail cars. It's 45 feet tall and 75 feet wide, using a standard 18-inch cubit, and you can fit 522 standard railroad stock cars in there. Go ahead, Mike.
Earlier, I thought you said that it was as wide as a football field.
If you're using the royal cubit, it is. It's 87 feet wide.
That's not a football field. 300 feet is a football field.
No, wide.
But you said it was as wide as a football field.
How wide is a football field?
Oh, as wide as a football field is wide.
Yeah, it's okay. If you use a regular cubit, it's not as wide as a football field.
It's the width of a football field.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Length and width, sorry. I might have misspoke. 522 standard railroad stock cars, and that would hold, almost 120,000 sheep-sized animals. That's a lot of animals, according to their kind. And then you've got, but if you're using the royal cubit, it would hold 750 rail cars, which is 180,000 animals. And that's a lot of animals to have two of each. And how much space do you suppose a cricket takes up? You know, I little tiny. Those cages are palaces for a cricket, right? I mean, and you look at a mouse, and maybe they put mice and shrews in the same cage. They're not going to eat each other. So you've got the logistics of this are entirely possible, and that's what I'm trying to point out here. The ark was so large and so roomy that it could fit a lot of animals. Mike.
Yeah, one of the things that occurred to me too is as we're talking about this, God imparted to Noah and his family the knowledge necessary to sustain those animals as well. And I mean, that's a whole field of study and research in modern time,
animal husbandry,
zoology, what they eat and what their needs are.
Yeah. By the way, do you suppose there were more than two rabbits at the end of the trip? Unless they kept them in separate cages, there probably were. only two. That's from a cartoon, I think. Bill Cosby, that's right. What a big boat. And God prepared this because he wanted to do what? He wanted to save a remnant of mankind and the animals. And so we're going to move on now, but I've already talked about animal size and stuff like that. So and the sheer size of the ark. But I want to get on to the. Next slide. That's where I want to get. So he says, it begins in verse 17. It says, "And behold, I myself," this is God speaking, "am bringing floodwaters on the earth to destroy from under heaven all flesh which is the breath of life. Everything that is on the earth shall die." Now again, going back to that little cartoon that I have on there, is this a local flood? No. When God is saying, so if you believe that it's a local flood, you believe that God is a liar, because that's not what God says here. God says that word "all" is kind of inclusive, right? It says under heaven all flesh in which is the breath of life. Everything that is on the earth shall die. Say again, Mike. Yeah, it's all inclusive. If you don't believe that it's a global flood, you are in fact saying that God doesn't know what he's talking about here. Go ahead, Bill.
I said this last week, but what would be the need of, if it was just a local flood, what would be the need of gathering all these animals from part of the world, if it was just local? There would be plenty of animals left over somewhere in the world to repopulate it. So it just that implication is that
and
it
humans,
was the whole
right.
world, even right. if you don't think the language says that. Why do this if it wasn't everything was going to be destroyed?
Yeah, and again, we pointed out last week that there's every culture just about on the face of the earth has some kind of flood story.
Yes.
And so this cataclysm, and that's what this was, is the world global cataclysm was so large and so intense that it has a memory coming down through every culture that is on the face of the earth. They call that like racial memory or something like that. It's everywhere. And so that's just another reason why we would understand that it was a global flood. Let's go on with the text here. Thank you, Bill. But I will, in verse 18, "But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. And of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female." And it's interesting that he specifies that they should be male and female here. I didn't think about this, but it wouldn't have done any good to bring a couple of females or a couple of males along. You had to have male and female. of the birds after their kind, of the animals after their kind, of every creeping thing of the earth after its kind, two of every kind will come with you to keep them alive. And you shall take for yourself all the food that is eaten, and you shall gather it to yourself, and it shall be for food for you and for them. Thus Noah did, according to all that God commanded him, so he did. So this emphasizes three times at least the word kind, just like in Genesis chapter 1. So how many different breeds of dogs did they have? They had one, right? We take dogs and we breed different characteristics into dogs, and we have dogs that are hyperallergenic now because they don't shed. That's not natural, mostly not natural, but, you know, we have all sorts of different dogs. We have Chihuahuas or Chihuahuas, if you want to call them those. We have St. Bernards. We have all sorts of dogs in between. But those are dog breeds, not kind. And so when God brought on dog kind, maybe he brought wolves and domesticated dogs, but he probably just brought wolves, which then became domesticated dogs later on, and were bred into different species. The same thing with cats. So you've got the idea here, and God specifically says kind in here at least three times, four times actually. I don't want to minimize this or minimize it too much, but entirely possible to fit the type and number of animals we need to populate the earth onto the ark. You have a comment, Mike?
Are you using New King James?
I am.
And so in 19, when it says sort there, that should otherwise would be kind, right?
I didn't look at the NASB on this. Sorry.
Yeah, the NASB says kind.
Sort.
No,
oh.
Kind.
Oh, okay. Which verse? 19? Oh, of every sort. That's inserted into the text there. It's italicized. So, but the rest of it, you've got kind in there several times. And the emphasis again. Verse 22. What did Noah do? Did he bring enough food on the ark for himself and all the animals? It says he did. Did he gather up the animals? Did he gather up the food? Did he? I think this is great. God tells him to do all this stuff, and then God, through the Holy Spirit, through Moses, gives us Noah's response. Thus Noah did, right? According to all that God commanded him, so he did. That's a great, I hope that when, we just had a memorial service for Teresa, but I hope that in my memorial service or in Bill's or, you know, thus Bill did all that God commanded him. Wouldn't that be a great epitaph?
Amen.
You know, someone chisel that on your tombstone if you're going to be buried. You know, thus Mike did according to all that God commanded him. This is a great man of faith here. And how is he demonstrating his faith? By doing. Okay, let's see. This verse is actually part of chapter 7. I just wanted to point that out. It's in a separate paragraph, and chapter 7 doesn't start that way. As far as my notes, I didn't look this up this time, but it's part of the first paragraph that begins chapter 7. When you take it in light of the next verse, it should make you think, then the Lord said to Noah, come into the ark. First Noah did all this, then God told him to enter the ark, right? So let's go on to chapter 7. In this chapter, we're going to have the beginning of the flood. The preparations have been made. The animals are in the ark, and Noah and his family are in the ark. And then the flood is going to begin. So in chapter 7, verses 1 through 6, let's read this. Then the Lord said to Noah, come into the ark, you and your household, because I have seen you are righteous before me in this generation. You shall take with you seven of each of every clean animal, a male and his female, two each of animals that are unclean, a male and his female, and also seven each of the birds of the air, male and female, to keep the species alive on the face of all the earth. For After 7 more days, I will cause it to rain on the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and I will destroy from the face of the earth all living things that I have made. And Noah did according to all that the Lord commanded him. Noah was 600 years old when the flood waters were on the face of the earth. So if you go back to our timeline, now we know when the flood is in Noah's life. He was 600 years old. Now he's going to live another 150 years after this, I think. I think he lives to be 750. 350, thank you. I knew it was, that didn't sound right. So there's a couple of things I want to point out about this. When did it start raining in relation to when Noah got on the ark? A week after. Now think about this. So you're Noah. God has told you. Now, whether or not you believe that it ever had rained, because Hebrews 11 says that he did things of things not seen, which could be rain or it could be a global flood. But whether you believe that it had ever never rained or it certainly never flooded before, and God has Noah build this ark. He says, okay, get on the ark. And he gets on the ark, and it doesn't start raining for 7 days. you suppose he got a little antsy on those 7 days? You know, it's like, it hasn't started raining yet. But he tells him, in 7 days, it's going to start raining. So I just think that's kind of amusing here. That now, one thing I want to point out, and you may see this before, but if you go back to the idea of Bible criticism, you have the Yahwists and the Elohimists, those who think that there were two different authors that were then combined into one. One of their arguments is going to happen in these two chapters here. And that's because we're going to go back and forth between the word Lord, which is in, I don't know why that's not uppercase like that. It should be uppercase. Jehovah in verse 6, and God, so you've got Lord down below. And I think it's because when I copied it in, it changed the font. You've got Jehovah in these verses, and the next set of verses is going to say God. So they think, and it seems a little repetitive here. First, in the last chapter, we had, you're going to bring two by two, you're going to bring a male and this female in, and now we've got these seven in here. What's all this about in two by two, you know, for the unclean animals? So don't get confused by that. When God repeats something, why does he repeat it usually?
Emphasis.
That's more than likely it, is there's an emphasis going on here. So God said last time, two by two, but now it's actually, we're getting a little bit more information when he says seven of every clean animals and also seven of the birds. Now, someone will suggest that this means seven pair of animals where it says a male and his female, but then you would be bringing two pair of the unclean animals on as well. So to me, it's either one male and six females, or you've got a male, female, male, female, male, female, and then an extra male or female in the seven clean animals. So don't be confused by that either. And Mike, you had a comment?
Or a question?
Well, two comments. First of all, we know that when God spoke of Adam and Eve, he said the two shall become one flesh.
Mm-hmm.
So the use of the word two there is evident that two is two. I don't subscribe to that, you know, two pairs. It doesn't say
I'm
that.
I'm just telling you that some people would suggest it's pairs of animals, and that's not what, the text doesn't bear that out.
And then the other thing is, you think about them being in the ark for a week, there's several things that accomplished. First of all, it gave the animals an opportunity to settle down in their own enclosures. And it also gave Noah and his sons time to work out final strategy and details. I mean,
I agree with that.
If you were on a vessel that was tossing about, it would be a much more difficult transition to get into that routine of attending the animals.
When I was thinking about why, that's one of the things I was thinking about. It would give them a chance to figure out how to take care of all these animals. Because I can't remember, I'm thinking that God brought the animals to him, to Noah. He didn't go out and try to find a rhinoceros and his mate and all of that. God brought the animals to him. So was he taking care of the animals that whole time? No, he was building an ark. And God brought the animals to him, but you're right. I mean, let's get the animals situated where they're supposed to. Let's get the feeding schedules going. Let's get all that. And then I think that's a great point. Of course, we have to read that into it, but it seems logical, right? Mike.
We know that God gave people a long time to repent.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if the 7 days had something to do with that. The ark is finished. Just a little more time. I don't know. It's speculation, but I'm just wondering if that was part of the equation.
That's a good thought too. It is speculation, of course. We're going to read not in this next set of verses, but in the following set of verses, that God is going to shut Noah into the ark. When that door was shut, was it the beginning of the 7 days? Was it the end of 7 days? We don't know for sure. But God is going to do this shutting in. In the next set of verses, in verse 7 through 12, so Noah, with his sons, his wife, and his sons' wives, went into the ark because of the waters of the flood. Not that they were already there, but because God told him to go in, right? The reason that they're going in to the ark, the reason for the ark itself, was because of the flood coming. Doesn't mean that they went into the ark because the waters were already on the earth. In fact, that would contradict what we just read. So because of the waters of flood is just telling you why they went into the ark. Of clean animals, of every animal that are unclean, of birds, and of everything that creeps on the earth, two by two they went into the ark to Noah, male and female, as God had commanded Noah. And it came to pass after 7 days the waters of the flood were on the earth. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, on that day all the fountains of the great deep were broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened, and the rain was on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. So this is the beginning of the flood here. Now, there's not enough water, even if you believe in the water vapor canopy theory, there's not enough water in the upper atmosphere to flood the earth. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize Terry had a comment.
I was just thinking, all the people around him saw him building this ark. They mm-hmm. heard what God was saying. Mm-hmm. You'd wonder if they would be questioning all the animals to see that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure it happened in a relatively short period of time.
Well, you know they're going to be questioning their choices in a few minutes, right? Because it's going to start raining on them, and they're going to start seeing all this, all the stuff going on. Back to what I was saying. Sorry, thank you for your comment, Terry. The water vapor canopy theory suggests that that when God divided the water from the water and put a firmament, which is heaven, in there, that he put a lot of water into the upper atmosphere, mm-hmm. a lot of water in the upper atmosphere. But even if there is a huge amount of water in the upper atmosphere, not enough to cause a global flood. So God adds to the water by breaking open the fountains of the deep, and you kind of see this picture here. It's a bad artist rendition of this. I'm actually going to use a video in just a moment, which I hardly ever do. But the idea, and there's geological proof for this. That book that Mike keeps recommending by Walt Brown called In the Beginning, go search Walt Brown In the Beginning. It's the book is actually online, or you can buy it on Amazon and you can read through it. And he's developed a theory called the hydroponic, hydroplate theory. Thank you. Which is very much like plate tectonics. By the way, is plate tectonics a fact or a theory?
Theory.
It's a theory. Now, is it taught as fact or theory? It's taught as fact, just like evolution is. But plate tectonics, the idea behind that is that our continent, the North America, is on a single continental plate. And that plate is moving about an inch a year. They said as much as your fingernails grow in a year, right? That's how fast the thing is moving. It's really fast. But it's because you've got two plates coming together along the San Andreas Fault that's what causes earthquakes and stuff like that. Hydroplate theory is a little bit different. The hydroplate theory says that the continent was resting on water. And when God broke open the fountains of the deep, and there's some evidence for this, and go read the book. I was reading it this morning before class, that it would leave scars in the earth's crust and stuff that you can find. It would leave all sorts of geologic evidence that you can find. But those fountains breaking forth, he's suggesting actually it ejected water and stuff into space. They were so powerful. So when you see these fountains opening up like this, that's nothing compared to what Walt Brown is suggesting. But under such great pressure, underneath the earth's mantle, underneath the crust, underneath the continents, it broke open. God broke those fountains open. And when he did that, an interesting thing happened too, according to Walt Brown. Again, a theory is that that's when the continents split apart. That's when, you know, what they call Mu, the supercontinent, became separate continents. And how long did it take for those continents to drift apart? Someone's suggesting 5 miles an hour. Now, 5 miles an hour doesn't seem very fast, but when you're talking about a continent, it's like super fast, right? And so what happens when one continental plate hits another at 5 miles an hour? It would total my car. What do you think it would do to a continent? You know, and so and this is going to come in a second when we talk about mountains, but the global flood, this cataclysm, which is what it is, accounts for so many geologic features in this world. It just answers them where you can't answer them any other way. So the fountains of the great deep were broken up. Here's another artist's rendition of that idea, is that they broke open, and it's, if you look at the evidence, it looks like a baseball, the seams of a baseball on the earth. You've got it's in the middle of the ocean. You've got a mountain range and stuff like that, and you've got evidence of this subduction and all that. And it's like the seams of a baseball. That's what the earth looks like. And that's, so when it goes all the way around the world like this, there's evidence that the fountains of the deep broke open all around the world. Mike?
Yeah, there's an interesting global map that is in that book where
it
shows the oceanic trenches in the Pacific and the mid-Atlantic ridge, which indicates kind of a counteracting pressure in the whole of the globe. Mm-hmm. And it's just fascinating that the different facts that he brings out in support of this are really impressive, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, you're right. And he's using, for instance, we think about sea level, sea being level. I'll get to Mike there in a second. The sea being level, but did you realize that sea level isn't level? That it varies all around the world. A place like Hawaii, where there's a massive mountain, by the way, that's one of the tallest mountains in the world is Hawaii. If you go from the floor of the ocean up to the top of Hawaii, it's one of the tallest mountains in the world. That massive mountain there actually draws the ocean to it, and the ocean is higher in Hawaii than it is over the Mariana Trench. By like 30 feet or something like that, it's a huge amount of difference. Sea level is not level. Mike, you have a comment? But that's the kind of thing you find in Walt Brown's book.
I was just doing the math in my head on the moving continents. Never heard that before, but if it was 5 miles an hour, that's 120 miles in a day, 10 days, 1,200, 30 days, 3,600, 40 days, 4,800 miles, if they're saying that happened during the flood time.
So, and he is suggesting that. So yeah, I mean, it's quite fast. And basically what it is if you've ever driven on a road with a lot of water and you've hydroplaned on that water, that's exactly what the continents were doing with all this water underneath, and then all of a sudden there's this big pressure coming up and the continents are sliding away from that. And the idea is that it broke right through the middle of the continent. Go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, so I've heard a lot of stuff from Don Patton, which he's a geologist.
Yep.
And he works with a lot of scientists and mathematicians and all sorts of different stuff in this area. And if you're going to have a theory that, hey, the continents, you know, look like puzzle pieces and it looks like they separated, they actually know how to look for the evidence, like seeing the scars of this different stuff. And yep. They've been studying it for years.
Yep.
I mean, way before they were born, it's been studied. But today he talks about how they spend tons of money on building these computer systems just to test the different theories of the continents moving.
Yeah.
And so they test, okay, was it done in a million years? Was it done in this amount of time? Was it done with lava? Was it done with, you know, a meteor, right? When they put the numbers through, the only thing that works is a global flood and the continents moved at a pretty rapid pace, or else it would have destroyed the continents. It wouldn't have stayed in puzzle pieces.
Yeah, I'm going to get to this a little bit in my notes, but when I was in school, they taught me, when we're talking about geography of the United States, we have two mountain ranges in the United States, basically. We have the Appalachians and we have the Rockies. What did they teach me about the Appalachians? That they were old. What did they teach me about the Rockies? They were young, right? And in fact, when we were at the Grand Tetons last summer, it says that those mountains are still growing, that they're still coming up higher. So when we get to the water prevailing on the earth, and I'll just skip that when I get to it, how high were the mountains that the ark went over the top of? Well, if you think about the Appalachians being old mountains, those could have been pre-flood mountains, right? They were there. They've shown the erosion and stuff of the ages and stuff like that. The Rockies, not as much. So if you were going to put those into flood geology, what would have happened? The Appalachians would have been there before the flood. And by the way, how tall is the highest Appalachian mountain? It's about 6,600 feet. How tall is the... So by the way, this is a trick question. What's the tallest Rocky Mountain peak? You going to say Mount Rainier? Because it's fifth. What's the tallest mountain in the United States? It's Mount Whitney in California. Mount Rainier is... Yeah, Continental, right. I'm not talking about Denali or yeah, you're right. Sorry. Continental. Thank you, Don, for making me sure I was honest there. But Mount Whitney is the tallest. Mount Rainier is actually the fifth tallest. There are several Rocky Mountains that are taller in Colorado and stuff. Those mountains are tall. Now, when you're talking about the flood water prevailing on the earth and the ark being raised 15 cubits higher than any mountain, we're thinking Mount Everest, which is 29,000 feet tall. And that's so much water. But you're making an assumption that those mountains existed at that point in time, right? And in fact, Mount Ararat is like 16,000 feet tall. It's actually taller than Mount Rainier. But you're making an assumption also that it was always that tall. So you've got, because again, who wrote the book of Genesis? Moses did. When did he write the book of Genesis? Before the flood or after the flood? After the flood, quite a bit after the flood. Did the mountains of Ararat exist after the flood? Absolutely. Did they exist before the flood? We don't know. We really don't know. Because the face of the earth changed in this flood. And by the way, the flood accounts... remember I read the story of Fanny, what's her name, where she saw seashells in the middle of South Dakota or something like that on the high mountains and stuff. So much can be explained by there being water all over the world. You know, instead of taking, Joe's got a comment, instead of taking millions of years to create oil and coal and all that stuff, you can form those in a matter of months. If you have enough animals and vegetables and stuff that are under a lot of dirt and pressure, the flood can explain so much. Oil, yeah, sure, we call it fossil fuel, but it could have been men in those fossils too. All the men in the world, all the animals in the world, all the plants in the world, all that pressure of all that water. It's not all the stuff that we see in our world today. The Grand Canyon can be explained by a global flood. And I'll explain that in a little bit. But Joe, you have a comment?
Well, in the Genesis account, the Garden of Eden, there were four rivers that flowed out of it. And,
yep.
And I forget, one of them was the Tigris.
Yep.
Well, the Tigris exists, two of the rivers exist today, but the other two don't.
Right.
So that was before the flood, so things changed.
Yeah, and I mentioned that when we were talking about that, Joe, that even if they call the Tigris what it is, or Hiddekel, or Euphrates, that doesn't mean that those are the same rivers that existed before the flood, but that they came out of the ark and said, well, we'll call this one the same thing we used to call it, you know, and we'll call this one the same thing we used to call it, which is Euphrates and which is Tigris. So you're right, the face of the earth changed so drastically during the flood that I don't think we can underestimate what it did to geology, what it did to all the, you know, everything on the earth. Karen, you have a comment?
Well, I was going to say, you can imagine not just water coming up and
yep.
whatever coming down, you
yep.
know, but everything else. I mean, just in our area, when there's a flood, it's massive. I mean, trees, roots, huge things are coming down. I couldn't even imagine.
Yep.
When you're standing there, it's a shake.
Yep.
Because it's a shake when it's coming down, it's powerful.
I've got a video here in just a second that I want to get into today's class. So I'll take your comment, Mike. But exactly right, because if the fountains of the deep broke open and it looked like that picture there, what's that water going to happen? What's that water going to do? It's not going to just stay up in the air. It's going to go out like that, right? And it's going to be like the biggest tsunami you've ever seen. A tidal wave is what we would call it, right? Where you've got not a 5-foot wall of water, but, you know, a 30 or 40 or 50 or 60-foot, you know, huge wall of water just coming in. And what's it going to do to plants and trees and all that? It's just going to knock them over. Just look at the hurricane that just happened in Florida, right? The storm surge alone, they were talking about, someone was doing a video of Tampa Bay, and Tampa Bay was dry. Why? Because the hurricane had sucked the water out of it. And what happened to that water? The hurricane gave it back, right? And it just flooded, and you've got people with their houses underwater and all that, that wouldn't normally have their house underwater. You know, so you're right, Karen. Trees, animals, plants, people, everything covered with sand and soil, and the sedimentary rocks kind of show that. It's wonderful to see, especially if you look at it in light of flood. But if you try to look at it in light of, you know, the geologic column, you're going to be disappointed. Mike, go ahead.
Okay. Earlier we talked about the speed at which the plates moved,
yeah.
And you know, and calculations that Mike made. But there were two different columns, you know, one in the Atlantic, one in the Pacific. And if the land mass was between those two columns, as it pushed in one direction, there was a mass coming in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
And that's how we have the heaping up of the mountains.
Right.
Anyway.
Right. And Mike makes a great point, and I probably don't have the time to explain it and everything, but he's exactly right. That's why I think the Rocky Mountains are new mountains. I think they happened in the flood. And the older mountains were lower, and so when you're talking about, you know, 6,000 feet and then 15 cubits above the highest mountain, well, we don't know what the highest mountain was before the flood. It wasn't Mount Everest. Mount Everest is a new mountain. It wasn't Mount Rainier. Mount Rainier is a new mountain. So keep that in mind. Now, let's see if this works. I don't know if it'll work. Oh, it is. So this is the door of the ark. And you notice there's not a person closing that door. It's God closing that door, right? And you can ignore the little clock at the bottom. But this is what I wanted to kind of show. The illustration, the fountains of the deep breaking open. Could you imagine being in that boat? There's a little boat there. Ruh-roh. And then you've got the water, and again, you've got the water coming at it from both sides, like Mike was talking about. Just huge amount of water in the fountains. And this isn't showing the cloud cover and the rains falling and stuff like that. In fact, it's a sunny day, which I think they get that part wrong. But imagine being on that beach Well, actually, you don't have to imagine it because they're going to show a woman playing Moncala with her daughter in the next little scene here. Yeah, they're just playing. They're going all. And this is actually totally biblical, right? Because in the days of Noah, they were giving and receiving and giving in marriage and, you know, doing all sorts of things. And then the flood happened. These two were just playing. These guys are at the market and they start running. It's not going to do them much good, right? But again, you've got these global floodwaters, the fountains of the deep going. And maybe next week, because we're almost out of time, we'll answer maybe where that water went. Because that's a lot of water. But again, if God thrusted up the earth in places, it's going to be, and not only did he thrust up, he dropped down. How deep is the Mariana Trench?
7 miles,
and it's like 500 miles. No, it's longer than that. It's hugely wide, hugely long. If that didn't exist before the flood, that would hold a lot of water. So maybe we'll talk about it now. Isn't that kind of a cool illustration?
Yeah.
And the only reason I did that video here is because I think it really gives a feel for what might have happened. Now, again, this is an artist's rendition. We don't have any eyewitnesses that are alive except God. Right, so when God said he broke open the fountains of the deep, we just have to assume that that was a serious thing. Now, by the way, it wasn't until like this century, the last century, that we realized that there's still fresh water coming out of the bottom of the ocean. And there are vents, they call them vents. The fresh water is coming out from underneath the bottom of the ocean even now. And it's great because it's over in the book of Job, and I don't think I have it, but Job speaks of the fountains of the deep as well in the book of Job. So even way before we figured it out that there's fresh water coming out of the ocean, God knew about it, and God told Job about it. So again, we're just about out of time, so I don't think I'm going to go on. I'll stop there. Do we have any comments before we close for today? I appreciate your time. Oh, wait, Mike has a comment. Quick.
So when God made the world, all the animals, all the people, was there gold on the earth? Was there granite? Was there any coal? Did he create coal? Did he create oil? Are those things only after he made the earth, or could he have made those when he made the earth?
Well, I would assume like precious metals and stuff like gold, which aren't created in a pressure factory like diamonds are. Now, if you'd asked if there were diamonds before, I couldn't tell you. But the flood certainly could account for stuff like coal and oil and diamonds and stuff that are made with great pressure and stuff like that. Gold isn't made that way. Gold's naturally occurring. Sam?
Yeah, the periodic table and stuff like that, there's certain elements that you can't make with other elements. But this is an interesting fact that part of the study of what you just studied is also studying volcanic activity.
Mm-hmm.
And geologists and scientists know now that a volcano actually makes the water element. You have the water element, it turns from gas form to liquid, but to actually make it, volcanoes actually do that. So it's just a known fact that they calculate that volcanoes weren't always around and they weren't as active as they always have been, or else our world would have been flooded by the amount of water that they create.
Yeah. So. Thank you. Okay, we'll close there for now and look forward to next week.